We need to live our lives with the end game in mind. You know what I mean? In other words, we need to live our lives in such a way that we always have the conclusion, we always have the ending, the big finish, if you will, at the forefront of our thinking. I was forced to think about this again, and I shared my thoughts, although I hadn't considered writing these down at the time and sharing these sermonically, at least not till I started preparing for the sermon this morning. Someone asked me not long ago, what's the secret to balance in your life? So I thought that deserved a response, and I responded, and then I thought I should write this down, so I did. Here it is. I'm sure there are times I don't maintain proper balance, but I thought about the question for a while. I really think balance is achieved by discipline in small steps, and no, admittedly, I haven't mastered that. I'm a work in progress. But here's what I'll say about it. I didn't set out to have long friendships 50 years ago, and yet I have friends who have been my friends for 50 plus years. I don't know exactly what my end game was when I started seriously reading the Bible, but I read a chapter, then two, then three, then the whole book, then I read it again, and I keep reading it again. I wasn't thinking about being a grandpa when Lori and I had our first date. But I was kind to her, and we talked. We enjoyed being together, and we became close, chose to love each other, chose to commit and marry, had two sons together, and now have three grandkids. It was the discipline of loving day in and day out that has brought us to the place of having grandkids. The first time I ever spoke in public, I wasn't thinking about being a pastor and a preacher, and now I speak at least four times a week, about 48 weeks of the year. I think it's the discipline in the small steps that makes the difference. I'm sure there are a lot of other angles on this, but maybe this will help someone today. Start today, be disciplined in a small way, and see what happens. I'm pretty sure Paul would agree with me on that, and that's a big deal. And the reason that's a big deal is because what Paul wrote was the very word of God. And I always want to be in agreement with the Word of God. Don't you? Okay. As we'll see in a moment, Paul had what I'm talking about in mind. Paul had the end game in mind. He lived his life with the final act always influencing the present. And listen, that makes all the difference in the world. And frankly, it makes all the difference in eternity, too. We're in the midst of a series learning through the letter of 1 Corinthians. We know that it was penned by the Apostle Paul. He notes in the first chapter that as believers, we're called to be saints together, thus the title for the series. So we continue this morning. Let me remind us what we learned from this same chapter when we were together last. From chapter 9, verses 1 through 14, we took one detour and then we noted three things together. First of all, the detour, much of how we live as Christians is counterintuitive to the rest of the world. That is, quite frankly, an understatement, but let's go on. Then we said, be careful judging the rights of others. Secondly, be cognizant regarding the role of others. And finally, we said, be cooperative related to the remuneration of others. You'll perhaps recall we talked about what Paul talked about. As distasteful as it may have been for me to have to talk about it, we talked about money and ministry. I promised you guys that I didn't need Creflo Dollar's $65 million jet, and I think, frankly, some of you guys were relieved. So this morning, we pick up with verse 15, and we'll move through to the end, which we'll get to in verse 27. So now let's get to the text. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, we'll begin with verse 15. If you're able, I'll invite you to stand, please, for the reading of God's Word. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision, for I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting. For necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became a Jew, as a Jew, in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Thank you so much. You may be seated. Now, you guys know that oftentimes as part of a sermon, I introduce what we call a detour. Just so we're clear, I think you all know this, but detours are not the same as the proverbial rabbit chasing that happens among some preaching. I never chase a rabbit in preaching that I haven't planned on chasing, so I don't know if that even counts as chasing a rabbit. But if I chase one, I promise you I planned it. The detours that I introduce are the same way. They're planned so that we don't miss an overall principle or an overall teaching from the text. This morning, I want to take us down one rather lengthy detour. And the reason for today's detour is because I don't want us to miss something really important that we glean from the overall text that we're studying. As is so often the case, if we're not careful, we miss something that needs to be noted, but sometimes it's easily overlooked in our attempts to understand sometimes some of the minutiae within the fabric of the text. We can miss out on some really important things that might seem to be at the periphery of the text, such as the case with the detour. So here it is. Pay attention to the subplot, rights, racism, and reward. Pay attention to the subplot, rights, racism, and reward. Granted, a lot of what Paul is going to deal with is about the necessity of preaching the gospel. He's going to talk about ministry and money. And remember what he says in verse 14. He says, in the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. And then as we move ahead through the text, Paul is going to stress something about contextualizing one's own ministry in order to reach more people for Christ. It's important that we understand, and we'll get to this in just a bit, he is not talking about selling out one's conviction for somebody else to experience some sort of cultural easy believism. That's not it at all. But since he has made it his aim to keep the gospel at the forefront, he's choosing to conduct himself and live his life in such a way that the gospel does, in fact, remain at the forefront. Paul has made it clear that he has some rights as an apostle. We dealt with that at length last week. But at the heart of his rights is his right to share the gospel free of charge. Even though he had the right to make his living via the gospel, he has the right seemingly not to as well. In fact, some would argue that this might be a chief cause of pride in the apostle's heart. In other words, he was so hung up on not giving anyone any cause to speak poorly of how he was carrying out his gospel ministry, that is, by not taking money for what he was doing, that he could almost idolize that notion, and it could, in fact, if he's not careful, overshadow something of the gospel ministry itself. But he has to be careful. We know, in fact, by his own admission, Paul has some moments of inner turmoil about his boasting. It would be easy to be so principled about this, as Paul was, that one could allow that to slip into an unhealthy obsession about not asserting one's rights. Further, we know that the Corinthians were obsessed with their rights. Because of this, they found it almost impossible to believe that Paul could be driven strictly by his love for Jesus and his passion for gospel truth. The Corinthians could have been distressed had their rights been taken from them, and Paul would have been distressed if he had not been able to offer the gospel without making his living doing so. I have no idea where the saying originated. I know it's popular, but I couldn't find a definitive source of its origin. We've all heard the saying, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Now, we could debate that over Folgers, but I choose not to. I'm not here to debate the issue, but I would say that Paul, please understand, Paul never did see his life in ministry ever as simply a job. And not just because he didn't make his full living from doing that. Paul saw himself as a man living on mission, living with a mission, a steward of a great trust. He understood that the steward has no rights, no rewards per se, but only responsibilities. Frankly, that's Paul's defense throughout this entire chapter. He says in verse 16, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. He says in verse 17, he understands it's a stewardship. So rights are a big deal in the discussion. We probably would not have missed that. But race is a big deal in the discussion too. Please do not hear my introduction of racism into the conversation as an attempt to make race the central issue of the day. I have no desire to make you feel guilty or proud because of the color of your skin. I further know that racism and race in general is a topic fraught with all kinds of angles that people on every side of the issue might take in an attempt to prove their point or to soothe their conscience. I don't feel guilty. I don't feel guilty for being born white any more than I feel guilty for being born with brown hair. And yes, I know one of those is changing. But I should feel guilty, however, if my attitudes and actions toward others in any way demonstrate an air of superiority or arrogance on my part. I should feel guilty if I ever try to prop myself and my race up by knocking down others or their race in the process. I can't speak to race from a purely sociological perspective. I speak to it from the perspective of being a man of God, a person who belongs to Jesus. And as people who belong to Jesus, we Christians are called to be a Revelation chapter 7 people. Here's what John says in Revelation 7, verses 9 and 10. After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Isn't that beautiful? Man, what a picture. What a picture of how beautiful and glorious and colorful heaven is going to be. God likes all the colors. Remember, we had the rainbow first. Every nation, every tribe, all people, all languages. Now, I know there are a lot of places that we might go to in Scripture to form our own views about race, and certainly the Bible very clearly speaks to the topic. But here in 1 Corinthians 9, if we're not careful, we miss Paul's understanding and ultimate edict about this, and I think that would be tragic. It may be a challenge for many of you to grasp the freedom that comes to those who could trace prejudice back through their lineage for decades or generations or centuries. It's easy to miss the big deal this is because as believers, we're aware of how Christians are supposed to live in relationship to all of humanity. We make the assumption, of course, followers of Jesus should have no room in their hearts for racism, but we say that because we know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. We know how we're supposed to live in relationship to people that are different than we are. But make no mistake, this is radical for Paul to say this and to do what he did. Paul says, to the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. How could Paul say that? He could say that because he had experienced the indescribable freedom that comes to the heart of a man who understands that all people are human beings. All people are human beings created in the very image of God. Paul had discovered freedom from pride in his race and freedom from prejudice through Christ. Now get this. He is nevertheless prepared to forego the fruits even of that freedom in order to win Jews. Parenthetically, contrary to some theological streams of thought these days, if you need a good proof text to demonstrate that even as the Jews are God's chosen people, they must repent and believe in Messiah, if you need a proof text to prove that point, there it is. Otherwise, why would Paul be worried about the Jews? If they all got in with a free pass just because of their Jewishness, Paul wouldn't have said what he said. Paul understood, as we should all understand, that we're created, all of us are created a certain way. Some of us are darker than others. Some of us are lighter than others. Some of us are more handsome than others. What are you laughing at? Paul understood the gospel was for Jews and Gentiles alike, and we ought to be grateful that he did. And there's no indication, and I love this, by the way, there's no indication that in heaven all of that is erased. In fact, the text that we read a moment ago would indicate otherwise, that every tribe, nation, tongue, people, none of that is erased. People are in heaven who they've been at some level here on earth. But Paul understood that our main citizenship, please don't miss this, our main citizenship is not found in the country from which we come, but rather, have you read Hebrews, from a better country, a better land, a better place where we will, as followers of Jesus, we will one day be. Every tribe, every nation, every tongue, all peoples. So the subplot includes rights and racism, but then also reward. Paul will be speaking in verse 24 and following about runners running, but only one receives the prize, the reward, if you will, but much ink has been spilled talking about this from what I think, anyway, is the completely wrong angle. It's important that we see, first of all, there is a prize for which we run in the first place, but too often the focus of this pericope of the biblical text centers on the notion that one can be disqualified. And far too often, what many take that disqualification to mean is much worse, I believe, than originally intended. We have to be cautious not to draw the wrong conclusion. Too many see this as Paul saying that you can put all of your focus into running the race as a believer and then end up disqualified. No, if you put all of your focus into running the race as a believer, you're not going to be disqualified. If Paul was concerned about such a thing in his own life, well, let me ask you, what kind of chance do you and I have? To the point, this is not about falling from grace. Paul's not worried about losing his salvation. This is not about losing the gift of one's salvation from the Lord. As Morris notes, Paul's fear was not that he might lose his salvation, but that he might lose his crown through failing to satisfy his Lord. A man who is a believer cannot lose his salvation, right? I'm going to try it again. If you've got it, you can't lose it, right? The truth of the matter is, if you and I could lose our salvation, we would. We would. We can't. A man who is a believer cannot lose his salvation, but he can discover that his service to Jesus was centered on what his own resources could provide for his own glory, and that's not a good thing. And Paul says he has fears about that. So pay attention to the subplot, rights, racism, and reward. Now, three thoughts quickly, the operative word being quickly. Number one, asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris. Asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris. Look with me, please, again at verse 15. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision, for I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. Asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris. Let me remind you, hubris is the characteristic of excessive confidence or arrogance which leads a person to believe they may do no wrong. There's some Christians that probably need to read that definition. Paul is not going to assert his rights in this situation. He doesn't want to give anybody the satisfaction of claiming that he did what he did for any other reason than pure motivation, his love for Christ. So Paul does not take full advantage of everything he could have received monetarily in his service to Jesus. That's certainly admirable. But even as we noted last week, that's admirable, but not a necessity for all. Paul has made it clear, in fact, one can make his living by the gospel. Paul has further made it clear that he chose not to. But make no mistake, Paul had to be careful here. In fact, you recognize that he indicates at times in his writings that he himself had a proclivity toward boasting. And he's going to make it clear that he was only to, and by inference, we are only to, boast in the Lord. Paul wasn't prideful because he was preaching the gospel. What kind of sense would that make? He couldn't be prideful in that because he was compelled to do that. Paul understood he couldn't be prideful about that. He knew it was what he was supposed to do with his life. It was out of necessity, in fact, that Paul preached. He says, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. As a side note, I fear there are preachers today who fancy themselves more as life coaches or gifted communicators than gospel preachers. I'm just going to say this and let you make of it what you will. There's something wrong, desperately wrong, if a pastor or preacher writes a book and that book can just as easily be sold in the self-help section of the bookstore as it could be in the Christianity section. Did you get that? What we say and what we write is either gospel-centered or man-centered. It can't be both. And if one is called to preach the gospel, he recognizes the greatest help he can ever offer is that which comes through the gospel of Jesus in the first place. I've got no help to offer you except through Jesus. This is it. We've got nothing else. Then Paul asks, what then is my reward? His reward is in the preaching. His reward is in the sharing of the gospel. His reward is in doing that without making full use of his rights as an apostle. If Paul had written a book, can you imagine comparing the Apostle Paul's book to Joel Osteen's Your Best Life Now? Think about it. Joel talks about success and wealth and being healthy. Paul's book would be about being beaten and left for dead. It would be about a thorn in the flesh and knowing the day was coming, he would die for his faith. Your best death now probably would have been his title. There's a whole subculture of Christian leaders that should reread Paul at this point. Listen, the reward isn't found in building Six Flags over Jesus. The reward isn't found in having the biggest fog machines in your sanctuary. The reward is not found in riding in a $65 million jet. The reward is found in faithfulness to Christ and serving Jesus in the way that Jesus calls one to serve. I'm going to make a bold and very distasteful statement here, but I believe it's true. When we get to heaven, a lot of people are going to be surprised at how many so-called Christian stars aren't there. Listen, you cannot, with integrity, call yourself a minister of the gospel or a servant of the church if your main goal is to see how much money you can squeeze from the bride of Christ. Paul said the reward is in yielding his personal rights. Isn't that odd? Counterintuitive. The reward is in yielding one's personal rights for the sake of the gospel, yielding one's rights for the sake of the cross. I love the story of Pastor Tom Erickson. Many years ago, where Tom Erickson was living, the public library had a system called Dial a Story. Anytime that a young child wanted to hear a fairy tale or a story, he or she would call the number and would hear a voice come on the line reading a short story, a fairy tale, to the listener. However, the problem was the number was only one digit different from Tom Erickson's phone number. So because small fingers would oftentimes make mistakes, Erickson received frequent calls from children listening, waiting to hear a fairy tale. Well, after several unsuccessful attempts to explain a wrong number to the small child, Erickson felt he had only one alternative. He obtained a copy of Three Little Pigs, and he set it by the phone. And then whenever a child called, he would simply read them the story. That's a simple yet beautiful illustration of yielding one's personal rights. We should take note. So, asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris. Not only asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris, but secondly, assuming one's responsibilities as a Christian is the preferred path. Verse 19 and following, "For though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all, that I might win more of them. To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law I became as one under the law, although not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings." Assuming one's responsibility as a Christian is the preferred path. Paul makes it clear there's work to be done. Verse 19 makes it clear Paul was free, but he was indebted to Christ. Therefore, he chose to make himself a servant to all people in order to see more of them come to Christ. Paul makes it clear there's work to be done. As one writer notes, Paul lived his life with eternity in mind, that end game in mind. And that meant evangelism with integrity, relationships with adaptability, and personal holiness with single-mindedness. Paul's desire is to win more people, verse 19. The word for win in the Greek language comes five times in this paragraph. And then there's a nuance, there's a change, if you will, that occurs by moving from winning people to saving them. The word that is translated save, states what winning can only imply. That what is at stake is not simply the failure or success of human persuasion, but rather man's eternal destiny. Paul is concerned about various ways to influence others for Christ, utilizing the utmost integrity in order to have the greatest impact. Thus, he says, "I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them." Let's bring this back to our backyard for a moment. Look at verse 20. "To the Jews I became as a Jew in order to win the Jews." Verse 21, to those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, that I might win those outside the law. What in the world is this all about? Paul is sensitive to his hearers. And listen carefully. He was less concerned with his Jewishness than his following of Christ. Get it? To wit, we should be less concerned with our Baptist-ness than our following of Christ, or whatever other ness you happen to carry as your label. At times, Paul understands it would be best to stay in his Jewish lane, like when he thinks Timothy should be circumcised. That's a Jewish issue. And then there are times he thinks it's best to discard that train of thought, like when he refused to bow to the Judaizers' pressure who wanted Titus to be circumcised. Paul says he became as a Jew in order to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law. Paul, think about this. Paul had been enslaved to religious ritual in the Jewish law. 613 written precepts he had to know and follow. 613 written precepts in the first five books of the Old Testament alone. Add to that the oral augmentation of those precepts, the things that Jesus refers to as the tradition of the elders. 613 things to keep track of. We struggle to remember. Do I go to the 8 o'clock service, the 9:15, or the 10:30? 613. Paul found these to be spiritual death if not given faith as their foundation. But even at that, Paul was willing to come under the law again if it could mean winning those under the law to Christ. And then, are you ready for this? Paul was equally as prepared to ignore those religious obligations in order to win those who were beyond the pale of the religious establishment and orthodoxy. To those outside the law, he says, I became as one outside the law. There's a clear dichotomy here that we need to recognize. We either go the way of asserting our rights or assuming our responsibilities, and the latter is the best course of action always. But with what Paul did, make no mistake, please don't miss this, Paul offended everyone. Everyone. There were Christians at Corinth whom Paul offended. They were less concerned with winning unbelievers and more concerned with maintaining what they believed to be was a pure fellowship. I've been in some churches like that. Thank God, and I mean that, this is not one of them. So let's be careful. Make no mistake, there were cliques at Corinth. I could talk about that all day, but I won't. But please don't force this text into a place it shouldn't go. This is not about hanging out in a bar so you can win alcoholics to Christ. It's not about hanging out in a brothel so you can witness to prostitutes about the love of Christ. And all of this, everything we've said in this second point, takes us back to the truth we learned in chapter 8, verse 1. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Asserting one's rights as a Christian is an unhelpful hubris. Assuming one's responsibilities as a Christian is the preferred path. Embracing one's challenges as a Christian is the formula for faithfulness. Verse 24 and following. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. Embracing one's challenges as a Christian is the formula for faithfulness. Corinth, as the center of the Isthmian Games, which occurred every 2 years, was perfect for Paul's metaphor about running a race. It would be like a preacher in Kansas City utilizing barbecue to talk about some particular point. Paul is reminding himself, and he's reminding his hearers, and by extension, he's reminding us, that embracing challenges is the formula for faithfulness. Not success, faithfulness. James Dobson, in his work Children at Risk, reminds us of one of the most tragic events during the Reagan presidency. It was the Sunday morning terrorist bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. Hundreds of Americans were killed or wounded as they slept. Many of us can still recall the terrible images as the dazed survivors worked to dig out their trapped comrades from beneath the rubble. A few days after the tragedy, Marine Corps Commander Paul Kelly visited some of the wounded survivors in a Frankfurt, Germany hospital. Among them was Corporal Jeffrey Lee Nashton. He was severely wounded in the incident. Nashton had so many tubes running in and out of his body that a witness said he looked more like a machine than a man, and yet he survived. As Kelly neared him, Nashton, struggling to move and racked with pain, motioned for a piece of paper and a pen. He wrote a brief note and then passed it back to his commander. On the slip of paper were but two words, Semper Fi, the Latin motto of the Marines meaning forever or always faithful. Always faithful. I certainly do not wish to take away anything from the countless heroes in our armed forces. But as I read that account, I couldn't help but wonder when the last sentence of the book of our lives is written, would someone be able to say about me and about you, always faithful? If so, great. If not, what do we need to do about it?